listening to Shop Talk with your host, Kevin Tates. Brought to you by Eastwood Tools. Everything you need to do the job right.
Hey, gearheads, you're listening to Shop Talk. I'm your host, Kevin Tates. Well, it's a whole new year, 2014, if you can believe it. And we've got another very interesting interview to kick off the year. So here's a riddle. What do Model A's Gary Allen, classical guitar, Jay Leno and David Letterman, Salt Flats Racers, Steve Earle, Gojo Hand Cleaner, John Prine, Mark Lambert, the DIY Network, Gibson Les Pauls, Roots Rock, Lucinda Williams, and Nashville, as well as Tom Sparks and Big Block Chevelles, all have in common? Well, the answer is David Steele. A guy who's got a dual life that most of us would envy, and a man that pursues his passions with a work ethic that is quite rare. David and I became friends while he lived in Nashville, and have remained friends for a lot of reasons, one of which is that we both believe in preserving the historical aspects of the automotive aftermarket industry and hobby. David is a successful professional live and studio guitar player with a resume that's as diverse as it is vast, and he grew up living and loving all things automotive. His foundation in the automotive hobby drove him to seek out the roots of the whole thing and study the formative years of hot rodding, all while touring the world in front of audiences cultivating his other love, which is, of course, music. Take a listen to what David Steele has to say and how we talk about the foundations and fundamentals that we live by. You're listening to Shop Talk. I'm your host, Kevin Tates. We're sponsored and brought to you by the Eastwood Company. Do the job right with Eastwood. Well, we've got him on the phone. It took a couple of tries because Dave is a busy, busy guy, but we've got David Steele on the phone. And Dave, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. It's great talking to you, Kevin.
You too. So you're coming to us from California. Tell our listeners where in sunny California you're calling from.
I'm in North Hollywood. I'm basically on the, what they call the valley. And I'm on kind of the Burbank, Toluca Lake side of North Hollywood.
The reason I ask that is because we're going to go straight to the heart of it. That is the birthplace of this whole thing that we wrap our heads around. That is Hot Rod Central. I mean, that area that you're in is the proving grounds. It's the genesis. It's the nucleus. It's where all of us gearheads look to, or at least look to at one point, for trends. So what's it like, man? I mean, is there a cool hot rod vibe there still?
Oh, God, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge part of the culture. You know, you feel it and you see it everywhere. And not just in, although you do, you know, you see old cars, classic cars, modified cars, you know, in traffic regularly. But there's something about the fashion. There's a bit of a kind of flair for the kind of youth-inspired hot rod kind of fashion thing that you see around a lot as well, and so I think it permeates a lot of stuff, kind of, you know, beyond the car world. Interestingly, and I obviously like that. I think it's way cool.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, and of course the climate out there is very kind to automobiles, as you and I both know. But so that's kind of a neat thing. Well, let's introduce our listeners to David Steele. You and I have a couple of different things in common. In the first place, we've both at one point at least been working musicians, and you are still that. So if you don't mind blowing your horn just a little bit, give us a little bit of background on well, let's just say, how did you get into the music industry first?
As far as getting into it on a professional level, I attended Berklee College of Music in Boston. Really kind of, you know, that's just such a kind of microcosm of the music industry anyway. You kind of are introduced to, you know, at least the skeletal structure of what the music industry is. You know, I started, you know, working, doing sessions and whatnot while I was still a student, and I was really, really lucky. I'm from upstate New York. I'm from Buffalo originally. But my parents, this would be interesting to some car guys, especially muscle car guys. My dad was a lifelong employee of General Motors, and he worked for the Tonawanda metal casting plant, where so many of our great Chevrolet muscle car engines come from. He started in 63, just as the 409 was transitioning out and into the what would become the big block Chevy. He was there until like 83, I think, so 20 years. And then, you know, the kind of crash of the auto industry, at least the early 80s crash, kind of happened. And we were relocated to southern Indiana, to a little town called Bedford. They had an aluminum casting plant there doing transmission cases and stuff like that. And so when I got out of Berkeley, I finished high school in Indiana. And then went to Berkeley. When I got out of Berkeley, came back to southern Indiana. And it was just the greatest gift in the world, because there was a phenomenal music scene in Bloomington, where IU is. And it was somewhat fueled by the presence of John Mellencamp and his band. Not only were they based there, but they all had these projects, you know, and these side projects and stuff. And I got to play in some of those bands and got to know some of those guys. And that's really what got me into the music business professionally, because, you know, I had no idea how lucky I was at the time that, you know, within a year of graduating college, you know, at 22, I'm playing in this guy Larry Crane's band, who was John Mellencamp's Keith Richards. They went to high school together, put the band together, wrote a lot of the songs together. Larry's playing guitar on all of those classic John Mellencamp songs.
Those great, great guitar tones too, man.
Oh my God. I mean, that I continue to chase and will continue to chase for the rest of my life. I mean, the beginning of Small Town Alone is.
I was thinking about that song. Is that a Telecaster on that song?
I'm sure there's a Telecaster in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
a multi-layered signature. It's a part.
Well, yeah, and you know, to me, not to go down this rabbit hole, but to me, when Larry Crane left the band in 1990, he took the sound of it with him. And I think if anybody is a fan of that music, you can kind of recognize that. But so he put a solo project together, hired me to be his lead guitar player, and this was like within a year of college. We were out on the road opening for Bad Company and playing arenas, and it was just insane. And I thought, I mean, just I was so naive. I thought, well, this music business thing is great.
Let me ask you something. Yeah. Let me interrupt you for a second, Dave. You say it like it's a like thing, but Berklee School of Music, and you won a scholarship, by the way, there. You didn't just pay your way in. Just for people that are listening, that's very prestigious. And I know from knowing you as a person and doing a little bit of research that you started off with classical guitar as well. And for me, as a wannabe guitar player and a musician as well, I understand how important fundamentals are with music and with what you and I both share in the automotive industry. So my question is this now, is that those formative years and that hammering home of foundation and fundamentals on the guitar, would you say that helped you walk through some doors?
Oh, absolutely. And be prepared for it? Absolutely. Yeah, man. I mean, I started playing guitar when I was 7 and quickly found a classical instructor who was basically just a Segovian disciple, and that's all we worked on. I mean, that was the only kind of guitar that existed, but what's wonderful about that guitar playing is it works your hands in a way that few things could. I mean, you know, maybe jazz guitar, you know, would approach it, but even at that, I mean, the intricacy of those pieces and the fingerings, it kind of prepares you for anything that comes at you after that, as far as physically and just an understanding of how the instrument works, you know, just up and down the neck. I mean, just the simple mechanics of it. And that foundation is, I mean, I recognize it still to this day. With certain things I do, I'll kind of realize, oh, that's funny. That's a little kind of Segovia-esque kind of voicing I'm playing right now. And I might be playing on like a pop country session or an alternative rock session. And I'm still using those tools that I learned, you know, when I started. So
I was about to ask you if those influences get drugged from those fundamentals into well, a part of your resume is, you know, the unbelievably great Steve Earle and some of the sessions, as well as countless live shows, I'm sure, with Steve Earle. It's quite a spread. It's quite a stretch from Segovian classical guitar to banging out Steve Earle tunes, which are, you know, they were in the country genre, so to speak, with Copperhead Road and that stuff, but not really country music, kind of rock and roll, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But that being said, I always have to credit this guy if I get here, anytime I get here in conversation, talking about, like, guitar and my beginnings with guitar. At 13, I found a new instructor in this town that we moved to who looked at what I was, brilliant guy, he looked at what I could do and what my talents were and what my abilities were, again, just on classical guitar, and he knew that I mean, we had talked about, I kind of want to try to play an electric guitar and see what that's like. And his, you'll love this, his way of bridging into that, or moving into that was to teach me to play the Dire Straits song, Sultans of Swing.
Oh, nice.
Which is
very
genius.
Nice.
It's genius because Mark Knopfler, the guitar player for Dire Straits, he plays with his fingers. And
he does.
That whole song is full of double stops and finger rolls and arpeggios, and it basically showed me that, like, oh, all these tools, all this Segovia stuff actually can translate into that, and continued to, because then when I, you know, started studying Chet Atkins, I mean, there's a whole ton of that stuff that translates into Chet Atkins, who, by the way, was studying Segovia his whole life. So
really,
it's kind of funny that, like, you know, by the time I got to Nashville in 93, I was so into songwriters and songs and that kind of roots American folk-based kind of songwriting world, which is now called Americana music, I guess. But, you know, John Prine was my first, that was the first band I joined, and I worked with John for a couple of years. And again, it's like all of those tools that I had learned when I was a little kid were continuing to translate and continue to translate, you know, into, you know, Steve Earle's band and everything I do. So, and I know that there is definitely, you know, you can articulate this a lot better than me, but there is that thing about fundamentals that if you really nail those down, they'll never leave you. Even if you don't take the time to sit back and remove yourself and notice it, it's there. It's there.
100%.
Oh my God. It's the make or break, you know, really.
Well, it's the fallback too. It's the reminder of what you know. And we can stretch the rules, but we got to know them in the first place. And that analogy is so good for what I do with the Paintucation series you know, what I try and help people do and, you know, try and help people get a little bit more information and get a leg up. And as you do as well, I mean, you participate in things like Cars and Guitars and try and, you know, show people that there's connections between the two and that there's, you know, room for not only mentoring people, but also recognizing nostalgia and the necessity to keep these traditions going, which all comes back to fundamentals. So these analogies between music and rock and roll, you and I share them well. And I want to say something, David, to the people that are listening. If you get the chance to go to YouTube and you punch in David Steele guitar player, you're going to find a plethora of really interesting stuff. You know, I know you're probably blushing on the other end of it because you're a humble guy, but you're an amazing guitar player, and I want the people that are listening to Shop Talk to check it out, because on top of being an awesome guitar player, you're a true hot rod guru encyclopedia guy too. So it's kind of fun to see you doing that Gary Allen solo in this 100,000 seat stadium when you're out on the center thing and you're just wailing on your gold top Les Paul. It's just cool. And then to think that that's my buddy Dave that's got dirt under his fingernails.
Yeah.
I want to point that out to people.
Well, that's very, very nice of you. I mean, I do I definitely have like dual citizenship in those in those two worlds, you know. I mean, you know, and possibly to a fault, but you know, I grew up with the stuff. My dad was a big car guy. I mean, just into everything. And
yeah.
And I'm forever in debt for that. Now go ahead.
No, we got a bit of a cell phone lag, so for people that are listening, we're not stepping on each other. It's just the nature of this, and I'm on Skype, and here we go. We're talking to people through Ethernet connections. but I wanted to ask you how, you know, I'm sure your dad was a huge influence and a mentor for you, as our dads always are. But have you got any other people that really have been an influence in your life as far as cars go and restoration and all of that world?
Well, I do, and it's funny. I mean, I kind of have this, you know, my holy trinity of car guy influence and mentorship is really, it starts with my dad, certainly, and then would include Tom Sparks, my dear friend who kind of took me under his wing in the mid-90s and really changed my life. And then my friend Mark Lambert, our mutual friend Mark Lambert in Nashville, who also changed my life just because, you know, Mark works at a level, and my dad was brilliant, certainly, but it wasn't his life, you know, it wasn't, you know, he had a family, he had a day job that was pretty overwhelming. So the car thing was his escape and his hobby and his passion. It's certainly all those things for Mark, but it's also his life and his day job and his art, you know?
Yeah,
And I've never been around a guy like that. Not on his, certainly not on his level. You know,
well, let me go out on a limb and say this. You rarely find somebody like Mark Lambert that goes through stress and life and passion and hobbies with the grace that man does. Would you say that's a fair statement?
That's a great way to put it, man. Yeah, he has such a great attitude and understanding of what's going on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like he just, it's everything. It's like he understands human behavior. He understands, you know, which, of course, that seeps into everything, you know, at all times. But, you know, no matter how big the problem is with the car, let's say, he understands why the problem is there. You know, and I think that's such a point of frustration for so many people in the hobby, where they just like, what's going on with this thing? Why would they do this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why have I been presented with this problem? And Lambert, so far, he has driven around that and circled back and is looking it straight in the face and I'm fully understanding it. Well, you know, they did this because, you know, Ford were trying to make 5 cars out of 1 platform.
Yeah.
And they had to cut some corners and they kind of fudged on some of the, you know, whatever, this part of the car is slightly underbuilt because of that. And I understand that because I understand manufacturing, you know. Like,
right,
Lambert
right.
just sees the whole thing all the time. And it just knocks me out. You know, I mean, as you know, man, being around him, you learn stuff every time, always, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
And he's a great instructor. I mean, he can explain stuff to you and in ways that make it, you know, like really, you know, focused.
And he's a wonderful television host, too. He had that series Classic Car Restoration on the DIY Network for 3 seasons, I believe. And he was wonderful at it. And so, yeah.
It's total natural. It's crazy, yeah.
Yeah, Mutual Admiration Society. Well, let's talk about Tom Sparks a little bit. I never met the man, but I certainly know of him. But for our listeners that don't, maybe there's a shadow of recognition with that name. Help us understand the significance of Tommy Sparks.
Well, you know, Tommy Sparks was one of our hot rod pioneers, certainly. Born in 1926 in Iowa, but moved out to Southern California with his family when he was very young, single-digit age. And funny enough, moved to Hollywood proper, and this is amazing, the little kid who lived across the street, who ended up being his first friend that he met when he moved here, was Fred Perillo of Perillo Rods.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they built model... Yeah, I know. They built model planes together, and they were off and running. They were both into things mechanical, and, you know, before you knew it, he was building an AV8 Roadster, a stripped-down Model A-based, you know, Ford Roadster, and racing at the Dry Lakes. And, you know, Tom was particularly interesting, and I think is particularly interesting to the hobby in that he tried and excelled at, like, pretty much every aspect of it. And I don't know if it was like I knew Tom really well. I mean, he was kind of like a second father to me. And I don't know if when he was younger, he just had such a motor in him that his attention span maybe was short or something, or maybe just didn't want to be left out. But, you know, he raced at the lakes. He was in the late 40s, a full-time employee machinist and engine builder for Eddie Meyer Speed Equipment in West Hollywood, which, by the way, at that time he worked there, he worked alongside, I mean, this is crazy. The crew at Eddie Meyer's in the late 40s was Tommy Sparks, Bud Meyer, Fred Carrillo, Ray Brown, and a young Ed Pink.
Oh, man. Okay,
was,
you just, wow,
that
that's
was
the top
the
of the heap. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's,
gosh,
you know, that's just a, I mean, that's a big, you know, that's a chunk of the kind of, you know, Mount Rushmore guys that ended up shaping hot rodding as we come to know it. But, you know, so he went from that to early drag racing, which he excelled at phenomenally. He built he broke away from Eddie Meyer. He and Ray Brown started a business together called Ray Brown Automotive. Then Tom kind of saw how that works when you put your name on something and started his own company, a speed shop in Hollywood called Sparks and Bonnie. And the first thing he did was he campaigned a Willys drag coupe, a 37 Willys drag coupe with a nitro blown, nitro burning flathead. And if you want to hear some minds blow on the other side of this podcast, for the drag racing fans out there, in 1955, Tom Sparks built a D-stroke flathead. I think it was a 242 or something cubic inch flathead, blown nitro in a Willys drag coupe with a 39 Ford Trans using only second and third gear with a banjo rear end and a quick change. And that car, and it's in drag news, this is real stuff, and I know the clocks worked back then and were accurate. That car, burning the tires the whole length of the drag strip practically, ran, well, the best time it ever ran was a 10.01 at 133.
You got to be kidding me.
And he was spinning that flathead to $7,000.
Unbelievable. So, unbelievable. And, he built the engine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that was...
Wow.
That's what really put Tom Sparks on the map. He kind of became one of the premier flathead engine builders in the late 40s and early 50s, and he was really one of the real holdouts. I mean, the overhead valve engines came out of Detroit in 49. The Chrysler Hemi came out around that same time. They were just better designs. They were more efficient. They made more power easier. They took the modification better, but he was one of those guys who just stuck with the flathead, and for anybody who knows the original Tony Nancy 22 Jr. Model A Roadster drag car, that car had the engine, transmission, and rear end taken from the Sparks and Bonnie drag coupe and put directly in it, and that's what started Tony Nancy on his career, and Tom was a partner in that car. But,
man,
you know, Tom also... built sports car specials, Ford-based sports car specials in the 50s, did great. I mean, it was very competitive. There's a great road and track from the mid-50s. I think it's Torrey Pines. And Phil Hill is coming through the S's in a 212 Ferrari Barchetta and right on his tail is Tommy in a Ford-based homemade special with a flathead in it. I mean, how embarrassing is that for Enzo Ferrari, but and John von Neumann, the car owner? But and you know, he raced stock cars at Riverside in 56 and 7 for Mercury, was great at that, and then got into the movie car business and built camera cars, and then eventually went on to, in the late 60s, start Spark Specialty Automotive, where he restored award-winning cars for Pebble Beach. And, I mean, I want to say the number is 33, but I could be off. But if I'm off, it's not by much, two or three, in either direction. Yeah. I think he restored 33 cars that either won or placed in their class at Pebble Beach over the years.
What an unbelievable honor that it is that you had not only to get to know him as a person and to, I'm sure, grow to love him as a man, but to be under the tutelage of somebody with that vast body of experience. I can't imagine how great that makes you feel to have been a part of his life and him a part of yours.
It's beyond flattering, you know. I mean, it's the thing at the end of the day that this hobby's all about, you know. I mean,
yes,
we all love the cars. It's all super exciting and super fun. And there are many days when it's the reason I get out of bed. And I don't know what that says about me, but you know, when you see out the other end of all that, it's just the people, you know, it's the people you meet. It's the friendships you make. And yes, it starts because there is a common language, but there's also a certain kind of person, I think, that involves themselves deeply in this hobby. And, you know, to put it plainly, I like that kind of person, you know?
So it's
a real nice, it's a real nice thing that, that really serves you when you're involved in it. Sorry, I've got a frog in my throat.
No, that's all right. It happens to the best of us. So you get that dry air out there when it's 70 degrees, and I hate you for it.
Ha ha. But well, it's funny. I actually have like a little bit of a head cold, which is absurd because it's like 82 and sunny today, and I don't know where I got this. But
well, Tennessee's been rocked with some pretty bizarre weather here lately. But let me ask you something about a little bit different subject here. You and I both share this as well. I love writing about this stuff, and you're a prolific writer. Your blog is excellent, and now you're writing for magazines. Tell us about some of the magazine stuff that you're doing.
Well, to be honest, I mean, the only stuff I've really done is contribute to Hot Rod Deluxe, which is a, you know, kind of the retro offshoot sister publication to Hot Rod Magazine. My friend Dave Wallace had been the editor for a few years, and I just became nuts about it. I mean, it's exciting for me to see that show up in my mailbox as a Rodders journal, and I never thought I would say that about anything. And it's like one of those crazy things, the way the planets align in this hobby. I went to a music show. I went to go see my old friend and boss, John Prine, play here in Los Angeles. I drove Tommy Sparks' old 29 Model A Roadster pickup, which I'm so knocked out to be able to say I'm the custodian of that these days. Tom left that for me when he passed, and it's an amazing thing to have in my life. But
well, and it was the cover vehicle for Hot Rod Deluxe, and there's a full-page spread on the story of that car as well, or the truck, I guess, if you will, as well. And it's a wonderful piece. And if you've ever read Hot Rod Deluxe, guys that are listening, I'm sure you've seen that front cover shot. So, I mean, how cool is that you drive the thing out of a rock concert, man? That's awesome.
Well, that's funny you say that, because that was the number one thing that Wallace commented on, was that I drove this thing, you know, this historic hot rod, you know, complete with a 1947 El Mirage timing tag and, you know, an Eddie Meyer equipped flathead between the frame rails that Tom actually built in the 40s.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's an amazing thing to be able to experience and drive and use and stand next to and answer questions about. It's such an honor. But, you know, I was like, well, you know, I know the band, and they'll have a bus there, and they're going to have some kind of secure parking, you know, just assuming that. It's like Friday night, and I drove this thing down there and saw Dave Wallace and met him, and I didn't know him prior to this. It's like 3 years ago. And he was just super nice, and I showed him the Roadster pickup, and he was knocked out, and we just really hit it off, and we stayed in touch. Excuse me, worked on that story together. And, you know, I just couldn't really keep my fingers out of it because it's so close to me, the story, and I do like to write, that I would just send them copy like crazy, I would scan original photos from Tom Sparks' collection, and I would just say, you know, a potential caption for this might be, you know. And so, yeah, you know. So
you
over
wore
time,
him down is what happened. You wore him down.
Yeah, in a maybe not so subtle way, you know. But so he came back to me and he said, man, if you ever want to do this, let me know. You know, I need guys like you, and I especially need a younger guy who knows about the early days, which they don't have a lot of.
Right.
And that kind of started me on, you know, on this, you know, it got me in this rhythm of helping them and with stuff about the Dry Lakes, especially that era, which I'm so passionate about. And then, yeah, I contributed some stories and some captions and whatnot. And I also used to go down there when Wallace was still the editor, and I would proofread and fact check the entire issue before it would go to print, which is hilarious to me considering how bad I was in school.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, that was just such a dream come true. I mean, that just being able to go to the Source Interlink offices and, you know, meet all these guys who are there still writing for Carcraft and Hot Rod, guys I've been reading my whole life, and, you know, putting faces and personalities to these names and being able to go into the Peterson archives, my God, is that just mind-blowing.
Yeah, that must be amazing.
I mean, you want to talk about, like, one of the most incredible experiences I've ever had. I mean, that's a lifetime of stuff to look at because they, you know, Peterson had, they had so many publications. But, I guess it's all part of the California fantasy, you know. I mean, it's just hard to believe how much of that stuff is still out here, and it continues to be revered and saved, preserved, you know, for future generations. And I really, really like that. That's a real passion of mine, kind of.
Well, speaking of that, let's talk for just a minute about the American Hot Rod Foundation. Are you still actively involved in that?
Absolutely. In fact, and for people who don't know, the American Hot Rod Foundation is a not-for-profit, which is was started by a guy named Steve Mamishian, who continues to make sure that the thing is up and running and properly driven. And but Jim Miller is the the director, and I kind of work under Jim Miller, and it's a thing I do when I can, you know, between music stuff and anything else I've got going on. And that kind of works for them, and it works for me. And basically what I do is I go around and contact hot rod pioneers, guys who are in their, you know, the latter part of their lives, guys in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, and I do filmed interviews with them. And they're usually two to 2.5 hour interviews. And you can go on the American Hot Rod Foundation website, which I think is ahrf.com, and there's a great, you can click on the banner that says Pioneers, and there's just a huge directory of a few hundred pioneers that they've interviewed since, I think, 2002, which is when they started this work. Might have been a year earlier than that, but anyway, right in there. And you can just click on a name. I mean, whoever you're a fan of.